Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Luce Program in Scripture and Literary Arts. Speaking will be Professor Daniel Lasker of Ben-Gurion University of the Negev. Professor Lasker's lecture is titled The Jewish-Christian Debate, The Interplay of Philosophy and Polemics in the Middle Ages. We begin with an introduction by Boston University Department of Religion Professor Diana Lobel.
I'm delighted to welcome our distinguished speaker, Professor Daniel J. Lasker. Professor Lasker is Norbert Blechner Professor of Jewish Values at Ben-Gurion University of the Negev, where he is also chair of the Goldstein-Gorin Department of Jewish Thought. Professor Lasker is the world's preeminent authority on medieval Jewish philosophical polemics against Christianity. He did his undergraduate and graduate work at Brandeis University, where he wrote his dissertation under the direction of the great professor of medieval Jewish philosophy, Professor Alexander Altman, Rav Shalom. His dissertation, Jewish Philosophical Polemics Against Christianity in the Middle Ages, became the seminal book of the same title. First published in 1977, it is being reissued in a new edition, which should be available next year, early next year. Professor Lasker's talk tonight will highlight some of the fruits of his research in the last 30 years, which will be reflected in the new introduction to the book. Professor Lasker has published other key works on the interplay of philosophy and polemics in medieval Jewish thought. He published a Hebrew edition and an annotated English translation of the philosopher Chasdai Kreskes' Refutation of Christian Principles, and with Sarah Strumsa, the Polemic of Nestor the Priest, an edition of Hebrew and Arabic texts with an English translation, as well as a partial Spanish translation in a separate edition. The breadth of Professor Lasker's scholarship is outstanding, and in no way stops there. He is also one of the world's authorities on the Karaite movement. Professor Lasker has published groundbreaking studies on Islamic influences on the origins of the Karaite movement, on philosophical issues such as the destiny of man, prophecy, and law in Karaite thought, and on the complex relationship between Karaite thought and the teachings of key medieval Jewish philosophers such as Judah Halevi and Moses Maimonides. He's written important studies on topics in the breadth of medieval Jewish philosophy, from Rav Sadia Gaon, Bachi ibn Pakuda, and Judah Halevi, to Maimonides, Gersonides, Kreskes, Albo, and Spinoza. In addition, Professor Lasker has published fascinating studies in the area of Jewish thought and modern medicine, including the questions of artificial insemination and stem cell research. Professor Lasker has been a visiting professor at Princeton University, Yale University, Yeshiva University, Jewish Theological Seminary, the University of Washington, and Queens College. In 2006, he was on the faculty of an NEH summer seminar, Representations of the Other, Jews in Medieval Christendom, held in Oxford, England. Tonight, he will speak on the Jewish-Christian debate, the interplay of philosophy and polemics in the Middle Ages. Professor Lasker.
Well, thank you very much. I want to thank you especially for this extremely warm welcome you've given me here. What I want to do tonight is to tell the story of the interplay between Jewish philosophy and the Jewish critique of Christianity. Normally, one doesn't think of the two genres of literature in one breath. One thinks of philosophy as being highbrow. One thinks of polemics as being lowbrow. One thinks of Jewish philosophy, philosophy in general, for the elite, polemics for the masses. One genre expresses the best in Judaism, and one genre expresses perhaps what's not best in the religion. So they're usually thought of as two separate disciplines. What I want to do this evening is to show how they're intertwined. I'll start out with the Jewish critique of Christianity. Before I talk about philosophy, I'll talk about a little bit about the Jewish critique. Is there such a thing? Is there a Jewish critique of Christianity? And the answer is certainly yes, despite what I'd say is the Jewish self-conception that Jews would discuss other religions only in self-defense when Jews are attacked. If Jews attack Christianity, if Jews critique Christianity, obviously it was in the context of defense. And in fact, there's a whole folklore of stories about Jews defending Judaism in public arenas or whatever against the attacks of Christianity. And in fact, one of the more popular stories is about the Pope who's going to expel the Jews in three more days, and he wants a representative of the Jews to defend them. And as these stories always go, none of the no one was willing to take this risk until one simple Jew, Moshe, decides that he's going to represent the Jewish people. No one else is willing to do it. He says, I'll do it. And one of the rules was that they wouldn't have any speaking parts, just hand motions. So I'll now read the version which I found on the internet in a Christian missionary site, which included because it had a long list of Jewish jokes. Anyway, this story, according to this version, Moshe and the Pope sat opposite each other for a full minute before the Pope raised his hand and showed three fingers. Moshe looked back at him and raised one finger. The Pope waved his fingers in a circle around his head. Moshe pointed to the ground where he sat. The Pope pulled out a wafer and a glass of wine. Moshe pulled out an apple. The Pope stood up and said, I give up. This man is too good. The Jews can stay. An hour later, the cardinals were all around the Pope asking him what happened. The Pope said, first I held up three fingers to represent the Trinity. He responded by holding up one finger to remind me that there's still one God common to both our religions. Then I waved my finger around me to show him that God was all around us. He responded by pointing to the ground and showing that God was also right here with us. I pulled out the wine and the wafer to show that God absolves us from our sins. He pulled out an apple to remind me of original sin. He had an answer for everything. What could I do? Meanwhile, the Jewish community had crowded around Moshe. What happened, they asked. Well, said Moshe, first he said to me the Jews had 3 days to get out of here. I told him that not one of us was leaving. Then he told me that this whole city would be cleared of Jews. I let him know that we were staying right here. And then asked a woman, I don't know, said Moshe. He took out his lunch and I took out mine. Well, even though it has entered folklore, the debate is not necessarily a laughing matter. But there was a Jewish critique. Jews objected to Christianity from the very beginning. And we see in the New Testament there are citations of arguments made by Jews against Christianity or against Jesus. The New Testament portrays, the Gospels portray Jews at the crucifixion saying he can't save himself, how can he save others? This probably put into the mouths of people later. After all, most people that day were probably home preparing for the Seder and the Paschal sacrifice, were a little too busy to attend this event. When Jesus' body is not in the grave after 3 days, there the Jews accuse it of being stolen. But in the Talmudic period, in the formative period of Rabbinic Judaism, up until the 5th or 6th century of the Common Era, there's almost no Jewish reaction to Christianity. There are some statements in the Talmud, some in the Midrash, but there's no real coming to grips with Christian doctrines. There's a parody on the New Testament called Toldot Yeshu, the history of Jesus, which is sort of a parody, makes fun of Jesus and the New Testament narratives, but it's not really a polemic against Christianity. It starts in earnest, what the Jewish critique starts in earnest, in Islamic countries. In the 12th century, the debate or the critique blossoms in Christian Europe for the first time, first in Iberia, in northern Iberia, which had become under Christianity, also in Provence, or at least what Jews call Provence, the Midi, Languedoc of today, also in Ashkenaz, in Franco-Germany, with biblical commentaries mostly. And then in the 13th century, there's an explosion of the debate. There are public disputations. Many of you are familiar with the famous disputations of Paris in 1240, when the Talmud was put on trial. The Talmud was found guilty. Barcelona, where the famous Nachmanides was called to defend Judaism and was confronted with use of rabbinic citations, basically for the first time, basically the first time in this manner, to prove the truth of Christianity. So there was a Christian initiative in the 13th century to convince Jews to convert, and this pressure, initiative, threat, if you would, continued in Western Europe through the expulsions, whether the expulsions in England 1290, France in 1306, 1394, Germany and Italy, various different places at various times, and then Spain in 1492 and Portugal in 1497. There's a give and take between the members of two religions, but there's also a discernible Jewish critique of Christianity. There are vulgar arguments on the level of this history of Jesus, which makes accusations, as I said, parodies the New Testament account, arguments against the impropriety of God's being in a woman's womb for 9 months, for being born through the birth canal and then needing to be nursed and have his diapers changed. I once talked about this in England and no one understood me, so for the English here, the nappies had to be changed. And yet on a more sophisticated level, there are arguments about the impossibility of an immutable God's becoming human. The arguments about Trinity, on one hand, they had verses. Christians would deduce verses from the Hebrew Bible to prove the truth of the Trinity. And other arguments had to do with God's attributes or the issue of divine unity versus simplicity. In fact, the Christian use of the Hebrew Bible for these verses gives a wonderful little, I like a passage in Maimonides' epistle on resurrection. I'll mention Maimonides later, but Maimonides starts out his epistle on resurrection by saying that it's not uncommon that someone is misunderstood, no matter how clear and how careful the person is. For instance, he says, Moses says in the Bible, in the Torah, that God is one. It says, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And what do the Christians do? They say, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord, three, is one. So Maimonides says that even God, even Moses, weren't able to make clear something which should have been very clear. I always use this as an example as a consolation to teachers who think they have totally lucid and then later on hear what the students think they said in class. On one hand, you have arguments against the Eucharist about how it turns into excrement, how it's demeaning, this is to say a piece of bread is God. On the other hand, there are philosophical issues of one substance is becoming another without anything visible happening. This is a little flavor of the Jewish critique of Christianity. There are a number of places one can read about it. There's no real good history yet. Maybe someday. What about Jewish philosophy? Well, that's one of the great issues of Jewish scholarship, defining what is Jewish philosophy. When I was a child, we used to call that the $64,000 question. I guess today, with inflation, you have to maybe add a few zeros. Jewish philosophy is an attempt by Jews to look at Judaism through the prism of the philosophy of the day and to try to reconcile Jewish tradition with philosophy, or more broadly in the Middle Ages, we call science, so that you would have on one hand revelation, the truths of the Torah, of the Bible, and on the other hand, you would have the truths of science, of use of intellect, of reason. How does one make a compromise between them? And there are various different strategies how to deal with this problem. I won't go into it now, but the great Jewish philosophers had to try to demonstrate the truth of Judaism vis-a-vis the threats of philosophy. Now, what I contend is that part of this enterprise, part of this attempt to make Judaism and reason, tradition, revelation, and reason agree, part of this enterprise is a refutation of Christianity. Now, I'm not saying it's the most important part of Jewish philosophy. I'm not saying it's the most significant part. I don't want a pan-polemical theory of Jewish philosophy. But I think if we look carefully through the history of Jewish philosophy, we see that there is a subtext almost always of refutation of Christianity. Now, when does Jewish philosophy begin? Well, the first Jewish philosopher was Philo of Alexandria, who died around 40 of the Common Era, who was a contemporary of Jesus. I will not claim here that Philo's philosophy was motivated by a desire to refute Christianity. I think that's a little bit too much. Did not include any anti-Christian polemic. The motivation is really reconciling the Bible with Plato, and he did in ways, for instance, that the Bible, according to his view, taught that the world was created out of nothing, and Plato taught that the world was created out of prime matter. His solution was to say that first God created prime matter out of nothing, and then he created the world out of that prime matter. So he made this compromise between his philosophy and Jewish tradition. The next step in the history of Jewish philosophy is in the 9th century in the Islamic realm in present-day Iraq, and the pioneer founder of medieval Jewish philosophy is someone whose name is probably unknown to most people here, which is Dawood ibn Marwan al-Muqamis. Not exactly a household name. I'm not referring to Professor Lobel knows him well. The reason he's not well known is he broke the cardinal rule of how to be known as a Jewish philosopher, and that's do something else also. So if you're Judah Halevi, in addition to philosophy, you did poetry. If you're Maimonides, in addition to philosophy, the halachic works. If you're Sajid, in addition to philosophy, you did everything. There are a few exceptions to this rule, but Al-Muqamis did not fit in. He also broke the second rule, which is if you don't write in Hebrew, get it translated into Hebrew as quickly as possible. That he didn't do either. Had to wait till the 20th century, and by then a lot of the book had been lost. According to a 10th century Karaite, Yaqub al-Kirkasani, this Al-Muqamis had once been a Christian, or once had converted to Christianity, and had returned to Judaism and then refuted Christianity with which he was familiar. It's interesting because we generally think of the prohibition in the Islamic realm of converting from one dhimmi religion to another. In other words, if you want to convert, if you don't like the religion you have, the only way of changing in Islamic law is to upgrade to Islam and not to stay on the same level of the protected religions, the religions of revelation. But yet there were people who did convert, Christians to Judaism, Jews to Christianity, and Al-Muqamis apparently was one of them, and he did it twice. First, the Christianity came back. So he wrote a philosophical work called The 20 Treatises and two separate anti-Christian treatises. And the philosophical treatise is just chock full of anti-Christian polemic and these two specific anti-Christian treatises. And what's interesting, I find, is the fact he also wrote an anti-Buddhist polemic. That, unfortunately, is lost and certainly may be a good seller in Israel today with the influence of Buddhism. Anyway, Al-Muqamis' philosophy and theology were much influenced by his Christian teachers and also by the Islamic form of theology called Kalam, which is a combination of a methodology of discourse, of debate, and theology, which is intended to prove the truth of religion. Now, the major subjects of Kalam are the unity of God and the justice of God. So these are the people of unity and justice. And one can't discuss divine unity without discussing those who deny God's absolute unity. And therefore, if you look at the 20 chapters of which we have about 20 treatises of Al-Muqamis, of which we have 16 or so, and some of them have lacunae, the anti-Christian sections are predominant. All the discussions of God's unity use the Christians as foils, as those who don't agree with the truth of the unity of God. The next great Jewish philosopher, the one whose name is probably known to most people in this room, is Sadia ben Yosef Gaon. Sadia ben Yosef, originally of Fayyum in Egypt, became the head of the academy in Iraq, in Sura, but it was in Baghdad, who died in 942, so over 1,000 years ago. He was the first well-known Jewish philosopher, probably because he did everything else. He translated the Bible into Arabic. He commented on the Bible. He polemicized about the calendar. He polemicized the Karaites. He wrote books of philology. He wrote history, chronology. He wrote poetry. There's no end to his what he wrote. And three sections in his magnum opus, The Opinions and Doctrines, are devoted to Christianity. One about Trinity and Incarnation, one part about the abrogation of the Torah, and one about the Messiah. So I would conclude that at the dawn of medieval Jewish philosophy, or the dawn of medieval Jewish philosophy is also the dawn of the Jewish critique of Christianity. And notice that all this is in the absence of a Christian mission to the Jews. There are many Christians living in Islamic countries. One sometimes tends to forget that Muslims were a minority, at least the first century, maybe the second Muslim century, in many areas of Muslim rule. The rulers were Arabs who came from the Arabian Peninsula, but most of the population retained their original religions. There's no Christian mission because, as I noted, it was basically forbidden to convert. Certainly it was going to be forbidden to actively try to make people convert. And yet Jews try to refute Christianity. In fact, I would argue that, at least what's extant, we have more Jewish polemics against Christianity in Islamic countries than we have Jewish polemics against Islam in Islamic countries. So that Christianity somehow was seen either as a greater challenge or more important to refute than Islam. And there are other issues involved. There's certainly the dangers involved in Islamic countries of criticizing Islam, but there are dangers in Christian countries of criticizing Christianity. Jews were very comfortable in Islamic countries, so that might also have taken a played a part. Or if one looks at Islamic theology and compares it with Jewish theology, the differences are not that great. Both are religions of a monotheistic God, an absolute monotheistic God. Both are religions of law. Both are religions of revelation. Both are religions that have certain dietary laws, purity laws, the whole range of its, they're religions of law. And the only real difference is that the Muslims claim that Muhammad was the last and greatest prophet, and Jews claimed that Muhammad could not abrogate the Torah and Judaism. Whether Muhammad was a prophet, certain Jews thought he was a prophet to the Muslims. Whether or not there's value in Islam, certain Jews thought that there was value, that it prepared the way for the authentic Messiah. When the authentic Messiah would come, Christianity and Islam had already spread the word, as it were, and therefore it would be easier for that Messiah to be accepted. I started out with, I mentioned Babylonia or Iraq of today. The Jewish critique of Christianity accompanies Jewish philosophy across North Africa. We don't have too many people in North Africa. We have Isaac Israeli, Dunash ibn Tamim, who not so much, don't have comments about Christianity as such, but arrives in Iberia or Andalusia, the Muslim Spain. And here, I'd say probably the first person to mention Christianity and sort of refute it, not seriously, but at least say his arguments refute Christianity, is someone that Professor Lobel knows very well, Bachi ibn Pakuda, the author of The Duties of the Heart, where in his discussions of divine unity, say these arguments refute the Christians. By the way, if you should use the Ibn Tibbon translation in the regular editions of the of that book, you won't find it there. It's been censored out. But in the original, it says that. The truth is that his arguments don't refute Christianity. They refute only dualism, but that's what he says. But in the 12th century, there's a blossoming of both Jewish philosophy and of anti-Christian polemics, Jewish anti-Christian polemics, in Iberia, in Andalusia, in those connected to Andalusian culture. Whether it's Abraham Barjia at the beginning of the 12th century, who in his messianic works, in his chronological works, takes on Christianity to a certain extent, whether it's Abraham ibn Ezra in his commentary on the Torah, not so much in the commentary itself, but in the introduction, this famous introduction where he attacks everybody else's method of biblical interpretation other than his own. Judah Halevi, the author of the Kuzari and the poet, is usually not thought of as an anti-Christian polemicist. But if you look at the Kuzari, what's this framework story? The framework story is the king is looking for a new religion. Again, I don't know. I mean, I assume some of you know this book very well. Maybe some of you don't know it at all. This is based on a true story, namely the conversion of the Khazars, the medieval kingdom in Central Asia, converted to Judaism. And there are a number of accounts of how it happened, but the way Judah Halevi tells the story, the king has a dream. He's told that his intentions are good, but his actions are bad, and he goes looking for the correct religion. He calls first a philosopher, then he calls a Christian, then he calls a Muslim, and then he's forced to call a Jew, and he's convinced by the Jewish sage of the truth of Judaism. And part of being convinced of the truth of Judaism is being convinced of the falseness of Christianity and Islam. And throughout the Kuzari, there are all kinds of hints about Christianity. Some are explicit, some are less explicit. Or if we look at Maimonides, I mentioned that he, in his epistle on resurrection, starts out by mentioning the fact that Christians misinterpret the verse about God's unity. But there are other references, and this is a response that he mentions Christians. He says that Christians are idolaters as opposed to Muslims. On the other hand, he says it's permissible to teach the Bible to Christians, but it's forbidden to teach it to Muslims, presumably because Christians accept the divinity of the Hebrew Bible, and they just interpret it wrongly. Muslims don't even accept the authority of the Hebrew Bible. In his epistle to Yemen, he talks about how there were groups who tried to destroy Judaism physically, there are groups that try to destroy Judaism spiritually, and then there are groups that try to do both physically and spiritually, and he says the first is Jesus, and then the religion set up, etc. So there are a number of references in Maimonides' works to Christians, including in his Guide of the Perplexed, and their view of the Trinity as opposed to his view of divine unity. On to Christian Spain and Provence. And here, end of the 12th century, or 300 years after Jews have started a critique of Christianity in Islamic countries, they finally pick it up in Christian countries. And I think Provence, again, Provence is not today's Provence. It was what Jews call Provence, Languedoc, the Midi, is a special case because it's on the border of Svarad, Iberia, Jewish life in Iberian Peninsula, and Ashkenaz, namely France, Germany. At the time, Provence was not part of France, and I think even today the Provençal think that they're a little bit different than the Parisien. And the situation that I reconstruct, and I know some of my colleagues don't like the way I do it, but I think that what happened was that Jews were permeated with Andalusian culture, whether it's philosophy, whether it's exegesis, whether it's linguistics, are being exiled from Muslim Spain. Some of them, like Maimonides, moved to other Islamic countries, but some of them moved to Christian Spain or southern France, Provence. And they find Jews there who are experts in Talmud, but ignoramuses about everything else. Abraham Barkhi, at the beginning of the 12th century, is the first one to write scientific works in Hebrew rather than in Arabic because his readers, potential readers, don't know Arabic, they know Hebrew, but they also don't know any science, so he wants to teach them science. So these newly displaced intellectuals find themselves in a new community, and they have very little in common with their fellow Jews, with whom they can't discuss matters of philosophy and science. With whom can they discuss these issues? With the local Christians. And we have any number of evidences of Jewish-Christian, I won't say dialogue, it's certainly not the term, but cooperation, discussion, and I think the best proof is Judah ibn Tibbon. Judah ibn Tibbon was the father of the translators. He translated Bachia's work, he translated Judah Halevi's work, and he writes in his ethical will to his son about how his son Samuel was a translator of Maimonides' Guide of the Perplexed. He writes about how he worked so hard to marry him off, to get enough money for him, find him a wife. And then the wedding was so nice. Well, the archbishop and the bishops and the priests, they all came to participate in this wedding. And I say to myself, to whom does one invite to one's son's wedding? People with whom one has friendly relations. Well, a number of these Jewish intellectuals, finding these Jewish ignoramuses in the local population, started saying to their new neighbors, why can't you be more like the Christians? Oops. If they say, why can't you be more like the Christians, their Jews might think, well, maybe they should really be like the Christians. So maybe not that much like the Christians. And therefore, it was important to set the boundary lines between Judaism and Christianity. And the first two authors of independent Hebrew authored polemical treatises were two Jews from this environment. One is Jacob ben Reuben, who talks about his Christian friend, the priest, from whom he learned science, and Joseph Kimchi, who was a grammarian, a commentator, and the father of commentators. And the third group of intellectuals with the Ibn Tibbon family that I mentioned before. All three of them or four if you have Judah and Samuel, there are other Ibn T-Bones. Really very interesting characters. Jacob and Reuben tells a story about going to the priest to learn science, and then the priest takes out books of Paul and of Gregory and tries to convince him of the truth of Christianity. And then Jacob and Reuben presents his arguments, his friend's arguments, and then he refutes them. I give this often as an example of how one can't rely on exactly what's written in polemical texts to indicate that what's said there is true. So that even if he had a Christian friend, which maybe is true, and even if he was trying to be, the friend tried to convert him, the one part which I'm sure is not true is that the arguments that this Christian friend made were not in the same fashion as reported in Jacob Ben Reuben's book, which is in rhyming Hebrew poetry. So when those are presented there, I don't think they exactly fit. This is exactly what happened. Now, not all those involved in philosophy were polemicists, and not all polemicists were philosophers. But I think there's a pretty high correlation. And this continues in this area where you have Joseph Ibn Kaspi, who wrote many, many books, and in quite a number of them has anti-Christian passages. Nissim of Marseille, in his commentary on the Torah, Masseh Nissim, also has anti-Christian passages. So you have a high correlation between intellectualism, philosophy, and critique of Christianity. Next step, Italy in the 13th century. This is a period, especially late 13th and early 14th century, of high Jewish acculturation into the society. The first Jewish thinkers to know Latin well were, and to use scholastic works, were in this period in Italy, late 13th and 14th century. Hillel of Verona wrote a book, Tagmulei HaNefesh. He translated chunks of Thomas Aquinas. But there are two people of note for my purpose. One is Moses ben Solomon of Salerno, another household name. Moses ben Solomon was the first, wrote the first philosophical commentary on the guide, which is often not known, which included a Hebrew-Italian glossary of philosophical terms. He also had Christian colleagues. Nicholas of Giovinazzo was one of them, and he seemed to work with them in translation and teaching them philosophy. But he also wrote a very sophisticated refutation, philosophical refutation, of Christian doctrines called Ta'anot, the claims, arguments, which is based on the Guide of the Perplexed, Maimonides' Guide of the Perplexed, and Maimonides' account of Aristotle's 25 principles of Aristotelian physics. All right, so those of you who know what I'm talking about know what I'm talking about, those who not. The other person I want to mention is Jacob Anatoly. He was a member of the Ibn T-Bone family by marriage. He immigrated from Provence to Naples. He was brought there by King Frederick II, and he, along with Michael Scott, translated Arabic works of philosophy and science from the Arabic into Latin. Mark Saperstein has written an article, which is part of a larger book, about the anti-Christian themes in Jacob Anatoly's sermons. During the week, he would work closely with Christians, or especially this one Christian, Michael Scott, translating works. He'd go home on the Sabbath and deliver anti-Christian sermons in the synagogue. The two go together. The next stop, I would say, is in Ashkenaz. Ashkenaz, again, is France, Germany, and then later Eastern Europe. Usually not a place associated with philosophy. In fact, I had a student once who wanted to prove to me that Maimonides is wrong, that one needs to be a philosopher in order to be a prophet. According to Maimonides' guide, prophecy comes to only those with intellectual achievements. For him's point of view, it means being an Aristotelian philosopher. So I had a student who said, I can prove that's not true. I said, how? He says, we all agree that in France, Germany, Ashkenaz, Jews weren't involved in philosophy, right? I said, yes. He says, well, Rashi, the great commentator on the Bible, did many miracles. And he was able to do those miracles despite the fact he didn't know philosophy. And therefore, Maimonides is wrong. I'd say the general impression that Ashkenazi Jews did not know philosophy is obviously true. But some of them did have philosophical knowledge. And those few seem to be involved in what else? Polemics against Christianity. The best example is in late 14th century, early 15th century Prague in Czechoslovakia, well, today in the Czech Republic. Major representative was Yom Tov Lipman Mulhausen in his book of polemic, Sefer Nitzachon, but there are also two minor, wrote less well known, Avigdor Kara and Menachem Shalem. The late lamented Frank Talmadge published a two-three-page fragment of an anti-Christian polemic and thought it was a Ashkenazic treatise against Christianity in the Sephardic method, which it was. But I think that it's very possible that it's a fragment of this Menachem Shalem's commentary on the guide, if he wrote such a commentary. I think he probably did, or at least commentary in part of it, and a commentary in that part of the guide was an anti-Christian polemic. Next stop, late 14th century Iberia. By now, most of the Iberian Peninsula is Christianized again. In 1391, there are riots, the beginning of the great wave of conversions and emigration. 1391 was the beginning of the end. Of course, no one knew it, but 100 years later they found out. And it's 100 years in which the most prominent Jewish philosophers also engaged in polemics. Chasdai Kreskes, whose name was mentioned, his refutation of the Christian principles. I don't know if my translation is still available, but the text has been republished by Bar-Ilan and Ben-Gurion University Presses, not even on demand. Profiat Duran was part of his circle. Joseph Albo, his book of principles. Simon ben Semach Duran, who was also a great halachist. Abraham Bibago. And again, I would say that those involved in polemics were generally the ones who best knew Latin and Christian literature. Maybe not totally, but I think there's a pretty high correlation. So let me make an interim summary. Despite the distance between the two fields, philosophy, the height of rationalism, it's not parochial or particularistic, and polemics, the apologetic literature with so little, maybe, intrinsic intellectual value, they still went hand in hand. Christianity presented philosophical problems for Jews, such as the nature of God, which needed to be addressed even in the absence of a specific Christian missionary threat. Now, as mentioned before, that my first book, will be reprinted, and there are a few other issues that I'll address in the introduction I wanted to mention now. One of those issues is Jewish knowledge of Christian writings. In the original book, I deliberated over the question of the Jewish use of the Christian sources. The methodological problem is as follows. Many of the Jewish philosophical arguments against Christian doctrines can be found in Latin, in internal Christian theological treatises which predate the Jewish polemical compositions. That raises a possibility that Jews borrowed at least some of their arguments from Christian literature. And yet there are reasons to doubt this direct borrowing. First of all, Jewish authors rarely cited Christian authors by name, and it's difficult to determine the extent of Jewish knowledge of Latin. Second, when these arguments appear in Christian treatises, they're always accompanied by refutations defending the Christian doctrine. Jewish authors give no indication that they were familiar with these refutations. Third, the Christian theological works which contained arguments against Christianity generally presented the problematical doctrines in a different manner than that which is found in Jewish polemical works. Jewish expositions of Christianity are consistent with the Christianity of the anti-Jewish polemics, namely they reflect what Jews probably heard in debates with Christians rather than what they could have read directly in Christian theological literature. This would also indicate that Jewish polemicists were not influenced by non-polemical Christian literature, even if some of their arguments have Christian precedents present in such literature. So in light of these considerations, I took the position that in the absence of strong evidence that Jews are actually reading Christian theological literature, and in the general absence of Jewish acknowledgement of the Christian solutions to the philosophical objections to their doctrines, the similarity of argumentation does not necessarily imply influence. I suggested that some Jews may have known internal Christian objections to Christian doctrines from either Orthodox or heterodox writings, but it would be difficult to draw exact conclusions. Furthermore, I stated that even if the Jewish authors did copy material already found in Christian treatises, or in Islamic writings for that matter, the transforming of those arguments into a comprehensive Jewish critique, written in Hebrew for an internal Jewish audience, was a sufficient claim of originality. In the past 30 years, a number of researchers have addressed the question of the influence of scholasticism on Jewish philosophy, and there is as yet no unanimity concerning this question. With the exception of the late 13th and early 14th century in Italy, as I mentioned, there apparently was no widespread Jewish familiarity with Christian philosophical writings until the 15th century, a period which postdates most but not all of the philosophical polemicists. Among those Jews who were familiar with scholasticism and could even perhaps read Christian writings of the original, it would seem that the polemicists stood out. Yet it would be hazardous to make generalizations. A thorough reconsideration of the question is of how familiar Jewish polemicists were with Christian philosophy is a desideratum, but beyond the scope for tonight. Suffice it to say that although I still subscribe to the comments I made 30 years ago, I think they may be open to further adjustment and revision. One should distinguish, for instance, between Jewish arguments against Trinity and Incarnation, which are already well developed in Islamic countries and could not have been derived at the time from internal Christian literature, even though they might have been borrowed from Islamic writings, and arguments against transubstantiation, virgin birth, which were specific to late medieval Jewish philosophical polemics. One might further make a distinction between authors who explicitly cite Christian works, such as Prophiat Duran, late 14th century, and Judah Aryeh Leone Modena in the 17th century, and those who do not. In general, the question still requires further research and analysis. And there's one more subject I'd like to discuss, which is not specifically tied into philosophy, and that's the Jewish-Christian debate and the Jewish anti-Christian polemics through the centuries. I think it's clear that the polemical literature is not the highest form of intellectual expression. It tends to be repetitive, puerile, and contradictory. Philosophical polemics attempt prima facie to raise the discussion to a more respectable level, but they do not always succeed in this endeavor. Even the most accomplished thinkers are not necessarily above the use of invective or causticity when making their arguments. This may be one reason why polemical literature has often been overlooked. Yet there's another aspect as well which discourages research into the Jewish-Christian controversy, and that is this literature's unchanging nature. After the basic doctrines distinguishing the two religions were established in the first millennium of Christianity, there is very little room for innovation. The central question remains, was Jesus of Nazareth the Messiah foretold by the Hebrew prophets, or was he not? In a sense, the rest is commentary. Just as the central issue dividing Jews and Christians remains unchanging after 2,000 years, so too the polemical literature is essentially the same throughout the centuries. The same Jewish arguments developed in Islamic countries were recycled in Christian Europe and are in use even to this day. And those who want examples can turn to www.jewsforjesus.org and www.jewsforjudaism.org. And Scott, back there, informs me that in the websites of Christians arguing against Islam and Muslims arguing against Christianity, one also sees recycling of medieval arguments. So through the years, some polemical tactics have changed. Some subjects, such as rabbinic literature, were added as a result of Christian discovery of the corpus, and the philosophical critique became more sophisticated. Different languages and genres were employed, and polemicists kept pursuing the one final and decisive argument which would win their case. Still, the basic lines of argumentation remained the same. It is understandable, therefore, that researchers have often eschewed close investigation of this literature. Perhaps the scholarly achievements of the area of polemics in the last 30 years and the reissuing of my book, soon I hope, will encourage a closer evaluation of the medieval Jewish-Christian debate. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Lasker. Professor Lasker has agreed to take questions.
Just at the end, you mentioned that there was a major change in Christian anti-Jewish polemics when they discovered the Talmudic corpus and the rabbinic writings. What was the role of Christian converts to Judaism? And we know from Avraham Aguirre and Balei HaTosfot that there were such phenomenon in terms of informing the Jewish polemic against Christianity in the medieval period.
Okay, Usually one asks the question about the role of Jewish converts to Christianity in the debate, and there isn't as much about Christian converts to Judaism. One reason for that is that there are a lot fewer Christian converts to Judaism than were Jewish converts to Christianity. And I think it's Mendelssohn who points out to Lafater that one Christian convert to Judaism is worth more than 1,000 Jewish converts to Christianity, because after all, by converting to Judaism in the 18th century, one was just making one's life more difficult. or as Mendelssohn said to Lafater, your circumcised friend can't even visit you in your city of Zurich. However, there are, as you mentioned, especially in Ashkenazic literature, mention of a few people who have the cognomen Hager, the proselyte, and they apparently did inform Jews of Christian doctrine or maybe made some arguments against it. We have also an exchange of letters by someone named who was named Bodo when he was a cleric in France and became Eleazar when he converted to Judaism and then went to Italy. Spain, I think it was about 9th, 10th century. He went to Muslim Spain, and we have an exchange of letters in Latin. There are certain indications from the Cairo Geniza that there were European Christian converts to Judaism who came to the areas that are covered by the Cairo Geniza, in other words, the Islamic areas of the Mediterranean, to avoid persecution. But to make a general statement about the role of Christian converts to Judaism in the realm of the Jewish critique of Christianity, I don't know if we can make such a conclusion, but it's certainly something to keep in mind. To what extent we have these people who did convert started out being very knowledgeable Christians is very hard to tell. Remember that in Christianity, generally book learning, literacy, knowledge of text was really restricted to the clergy. So it'd be hard for someone to, other than a clergy who would convert, and it'd be hard to imagine Christian clergymen converting, certainly not in any numbers. The other direction is not true. The classic example is Abner of Burgos, who after conversion became Alfonso de Valladolid, who was the first Christian to write serious polemics against Judaism in Hebrew. And some of them perhaps were in Castilian, but apparently the original ones were in Hebrew, an exchange of letters in Hebrew, meaning that he was actually intending to use those writings to try to convince Jews of the truth of Christianity, or at least to justify his own position, as opposed to Christian works written in Latin, which were not accessible to most Jewish readers.
Can you think of substantial contributions to Jewish philosophy made through polemical literature?
Okay. I think that Harry Wilson has shown that the whole issue of divine attributes, the discussion of divine attributes, has its background in religious debates, mostly between Christians and Muslims rather than Christians and Jews, about the nature of Trinity and the nature of divine unity. And he also showed there's a wonderful little article in his collection of essays, Religious Philosophy, called Extradeical and Interdeical Interpretations of the Platonic Ideas. And he follows from Plato through the late Middle Ages how Platonic ideas become transformed in the discussion mainly around Trinity and then the divine attributes. Another example that I've written on actually is the issue of definitions of the term one. Aristotle in the Metaphysics and the Topics tries to define what one means. One can mean a number of things. We have one chair. But we have one lecture hall, this is if it's been early today, one class, but the class is divided into many parts. We can have one army. We could have one, well, let's say this was a combination of wine and water. Then we'd have one liquid, but certainly made up of different things. So there's Aristotle already attempts to define unity in various different ways, not for religious purposes, just as part of his definitions of various philosophical terms. The church fathers took this up because they had a big problem. They believed that God was one because that's what the Hebrew Bible said, and yet they believed that Jesus as the Son and the Holy Spirit and the Father were all God. So what model of unity could one use in order to describe divine unity, which is also a Trinity? So they were developing different models of unity. When it gets into the Jewish realm and the Islamic realm, you have Al-Muqamis's, again, his 20 treatises. One of them is a long discussion of unity, and it's all in the context of the Christian-Jewish debate, a Jewish critique of Christianity. Your own Rabbeinu Bachya, there he doesn't divide unity in the context of the Jewish-Christian debate, but why should he even discuss what unity is if we're not that in the background? And when you get to Maimonides, for instance, in Maimonides' Mishneh Torah, the guide, authentic, authoritative guide of Jewish law, when he describes God, he says God's unity, not one in species, not one in genus, not one in being combined. In other words, he uses all the terms which are left over from the debate. Now, because of the influence of Christianity, certain Jewish doctrines developed in a way differently than they might have developed otherwise. Let's say original sin, for instance, that original sin is present, the concept of original sin is present in rabbinic literature. For most of the Middle Ages, it becomes denied because of the Christian centrality of original sin in Christianity. It's only later, under the influence of Kabbalah, which itself might be influenced from Christianity, where original sin makes its reappearance in Jewish philosophy. The nature of even of emanation, what it means to God, the Neoplatonic aspects of emanation at different levels of divinity or existence, the understanding is colored by a desire to not have this confused with the idea of God turning into human. So I think there's a number of places one could say that the philosophical discussion is informed with this idea in the background, not necessarily in the forefront, but certain traditions of discussion got into the literature because of the polemic, and then they stayed in there for because they were part of the tradition of the discussion.
I hope that you'll join me in thanking Professor Lasker for his
You've been listening to a lecture presented by the Luce Program in Scripture and Literary Arts. Speaking was Professor Daniel Lasker of Ben-Gurion University of the Negev. Professor Lasker's lecture was titled The Jewish-Christian Debate, The Interplay of Philosophy and Polemics in the Middle Ages. We began with an introduction by Boston University Department of Religion Professor Diana Lobel. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skog and Matt Odette, with help from Mike Toda. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.